Welcome into a very special episode of Comics for All. On this episode, we're going to be interviewing the creators of Spencer and Locke, David Pepos. He also has a wonderful new series coming out called Go to the Chapel that we're very excited for. And also, don't forget to go and check out his other piece, Grand Theft Astro. But enough hearing from me. Let's hear from David where you can find him and his team.
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at PeposD. That's just my last name and first initial. You can follow Jorge Santiago Jr. on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at Jorge Santiago Jr. That's just one word all spelled out. And Gavin Guidry, you can follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Gavin Guidry. That is just one word spelled out.
And without further ado, let's just go ahead and hop into the episode. Remember to like, comment, and subscribe wherever you get this show. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at All for Comics. So thanks very much and enjoy.
Comic books it is. Comic books for life. Comic books for all.
And here we go.
In brightest day.
In blackest night. No evil shall escape my sight.
Cool. So with that being said, we are going to dive in. So this is going to be a special episode for Comics for All. We're actually really excited. Pete, our local amazing Twitter aficionado, has been hard at work interviewing this gentleman already on malice-corp.com, where you guys can find this show. But we were so lucky to get him, and schedules ended up working out. We were actually able to pull in the creator of Spencer and Locke, Mr. David Pepos. So with that being said, David, welcome in, man. Thanks for coming on.
Well, of course. Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
That's awesome. We're super excited to have you. Some of our other cast and crew are here as well. Some of the normal rapscallions. How you doing, Marley?
Doing pretty good.
Good to hear you. Allie, how's everything out there on the East Coast?
It's raining, which ruined spring break for some people, which was okay for me because I didn't need to deal with spring break traffic. But I still made it to the comic book shop, and I'm full of good comics, so I'm very happy.
Nice. Woo. Absolutely. And that wonderful jubilation with his beard over there is Pete. What's up, man?
Happy to be here, and thank you to Mr. Pepos for just rolling with me, just barging right on through with the incorrect pronunciation of your name. I appreciate that, sir. I appreciate that.
Very cool. So, David, first off, man, we really want to say thank you. We all talked about Spencer and Locke on our last episode that just came up today, and we were all just absolutely thrilled with it. We had lots of amazing, fun things to talk about, and to have you on is just really kind of one of those really surreal moments. So, thanks for being on, man.
That was my pleasure. I actually got a chance to listen to it just before we started. And I was the pleasure is all mine. I was so excited to hear that you guys liked it. And I was like, wow, they're so complimentary about it. Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and I appreciate you guys giving me the time to chat about the book, especially with our upcoming second volume, which can be hitting stores later in April. And I love talking about this book, and I love talking about this book with people who like the book. So this is
always nice. Thank you. We appreciate that. And so before we get started, though, before we kind of dive in, we all have some questions we wanted to ask. We're hopefully not going to repeat too much from the written interview that you did a little earlier. But before we get going, I would like you to talk about some of your upcoming projects, any plugs you'd like to make, and where can people find you and reach out to you?
Yeah, well, the easiest place to find me personally is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is PeposD. It's just my last name and first initial. And then you can also follow my books on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can follow, Spencer and Locke. It's just one word, all spelled out. The "and" is spelled out in there, Spencer and Locke. That's on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There's my new book, Going to the Chapel. That's on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Go to the Chapel. All one word. And then my upcoming sci-fi time travel heist book, Grand Theft Astro, which is also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as Grand Theft Astro, all one word. Those are a lot of places you can find me. You should also follow my Spencer and Locke artist, Jorge Santiago Jr. He's on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr, I believe, at Jorge Santiago Jr. That's all one word spelled out. And then my going to the chapel artist, Gavin Guidry. That is Gavin Guidry. That is one word. It's just his full name, all spelled out. I believe that's also on Twitter and Instagram, I believe. So yeah, lots of people to follow, but you won't be disappointed, I promise.
Yeah, but an absolute amazing group of people to follow, especially considering the preview of artwork we've got to see for Going to the Chapel and the volume one that we were able to dive into with Spencer and Locke. I mean, Jorge Santiago, absolutely. I mean, just I love what he did with this. I mean, could you tell us a little bit about how you met Jorge, like where he came from, like what made you so excited to work with him?
So, you know, we had not met before working on this project. And actually, the funny slash sad slash embarrassing thing is we've actually never been in the same room together face to face. We're hoping to change that at HeroesCon this year.
Cool.
Nice. We've never actually met face to face. And we've been working together for years now. Jorge, so I guess going back a little bit, Spencer and Locke was a very incremental process in terms of putting it together and pitching it. I had before that never really had this idea that I could write. Like, it just kind of felt like, who am I to write a book? And as I sort of wrote the first script and I really enjoyed it, and then I wrote a treatment for the rest and I really enjoyed it, I said, oh, well, you know, wouldn't it be cool to find an artist to, you know, put some pitch pages together and just kind of see how that goes. And I took a lot of pages out of Justin Jordan's playbook for The Strange Talent of Luther Strode. That was Justin's sort of breakout book. And I thought of, you know, he did a lot of really smart things for that book. But I think the smartest thing that Justin did was he hooked up with Trad Moore. Trad is just kind of, he's a force of nature. He is such a talented artist. And he's just undeniably good. He's the kind of artist that you're going to read that book no matter what it's about. I mean, you know, you could have just been hitting your head against a keyboard, but if you got Trad Moore art, you're going to read it. And I thought to myself, where's the next Trad Moore going to come from? Trad is a graduate of the Savannah College of Art and Design. I looked at the Savannah College of Art and Design. I looked at RISD. I looked at SVA. I looked at the Hubert School. Anybody who had a portfolio in sequential art from any of the art schools, I tried to look them up and just sort of, you know, would send out feelers just if they felt like they might be in the right wheelhouse stylistically. And Jorge was kind of the first person I saw that I was like, okay, he not only has the action chops, but he has the expressiveness to his work. He's got, you know, he plays with emotion. And, you know, that really kind of struck a chord for me because I felt there was a lot of kind of, you know, heartbreaking moments to this book. And so, you know, I didn't realize this, but Jorge was just finishing his MFA over at SCAD at the time when I emailed him. And it was sort of the right place, right time. You know, he was about to graduate. He was looking for work. He had been really interested in sort of detective noir stories at the time. And so I kind of hit him with the right pitch at the right time. And, you know, just sometimes the stars align. You know, I say
meant
that,
to be.
You know, finding a good artist, it's like dating. A lot of messages. You know, I always laugh. I survived online dating in New York, and I feel like that was the best possible training for getting in the comics industry, because you're going to deal with a lot of rejection
very quickly. Very quickly.
And a lot of sort of things that don't work out. But, you know, all you need is sort of that one strong connection. And Jorge, you know, he is such a consummate professional. He really is, you know, I think the most talented artist I've ever worked with. He's so versatile. I never have to worry about, can he handle it? I never do worry about if he can handle it. I just kind of throw everything in the kitchen sink at him and I just assume he'll be okay.
Yeah.
You know, well, I assume he's like out pulling his hair out after he reads my scripts. you know, he's super terrific. I keep telling him I'm going to ride his coattails as long as he lets me. You know, I keep saying, this is why I keep pushing everybody to pre-order Spencer and Locke 2, which you can pre-order our first issue. Our final order cutoff is April 1st, because if we get enough pre-orders, we get to do a volume 3. And I've already told Jorge what I think it's going to be about. I already sort of have a game plan in mind. and we really want to get in on this. So, you know, as long as the sales kind of justify it, we'll be there.
Nice.
So, that's, yeah, no, he's just, he's such a pleasure to work with. Every time I see pages of his hit my inbox, it's like Christmas. And, you know, it's just, I can't say enough good things about him. You know, he's just been such a fantastic artistic partner on this project. And yeah, I plan on working with him as until the wheels come off.
Well, and that's amazing, just mostly because it was one of those things where, you know, I pictured it more, you know, you talk about like online dating, things like that. I pictured it more like looking for band members where you just had like your phone number posted on pillars around the city or something. And he just like randomly snagged one. So,
you know, it's one of those things you have to do all your own outreach, which is the hardest part, because, you know, it's funny, like you'll message artists and sometimes you won't know if they're about to blow up. You know, I mean, like, it's one of those things. I remember one of the artists that I hit up, not knowing really anything about him and not knowing that he was just about to blow up, was, you know, Daniel Warren Johnson. You know, I emailed him to be like, hey, I got the book. What are you doing? And he's like, I've got a book of Dark Horse. And
I'm yeah.
Like, oh, okay. You know, the artist on Silk, whose name I'm blanking on right now, I emailed her like 48 hours before they announced Silk over at Marvel. And I was like, oh, okay.
Wow.
Cool. So, you know, it's very much kind of a crapshoot. But, you know, when you find the right one, you find the right one. I
was about to say, the way you put that, I could see that being very much as the, sorry, I'm married. Like, oh, yeah. Okay.
you know, like, I'm flattered. And, you know, I feel like Jorge is such a big part of why Spencer and Locke worked, why it didn't become like super bleak and super oppressive. And, you know, I think he's a big part of why the book was so engaging and really endearing to so many people. I think he's the full package. I sort of say he's like a young Becky Cloonan or a young Raphael Albuquerque. He's got that sort of style to him that's very fluid but very human. And you know, he makes characters that you fall in love with.
Yeah, and when you start saying names like that, I mean, if you're listening to this right now and you haven't checked out Spencer and Locke, please go and check this out immediately, because those are the types of names that I would absolutely say are in the same wheelhouse here, where Jorge is doing something absolutely magical on these pages. Yeah, that's amazing. That is just absolutely fantastic. So as we kind of get in there, you know, I would actually like to talk about some of the rest of the team as well. You know, Jason Smith, you know, where did Jason come from? You know, how'd you kind of meet Jason?
Jason is, you know, he's our secret weapon, but it took us a really long time to get him. Jason was the last member of the team brought on. You know, Colin Bell was actually the first person on the team, even before Jorge.
Oh, wow.
I've known him for almost a decade at this point. He used to freelance for me over at New Drama, and before he became a fantasy pants letterer. And so when I said, okay, I guess I'm going to put a pitch together, I was like, well, you're the only letterer I know, so you're obviously grandfathered in. But the color search was not easy. I feel like the colorist is, you know, in certain ways, they're almost even more important than the line art in a way. And I know that's a weird way to describe it, but a colorist makes or breaks your book. They're the ones that sort of sets the tone, sets the atmosphere. And if they can't play well with your line artist, it's just a no-go. I got my start interning at DC Comics. I'm actually wearing a DC Comics shirt right now. It's like wearing the band shirt to the concert. they really drilled into me that good color can elevate any art, but a bad colorist can tank like even the most A-list artist. And Jason was actually our third colorist that we had approached for this book. We had a colorist who they were very nice. It just wasn't the right fit with Jorge's art. And then we found another colorist who just kind of took the money and bailed. And so I was kind of desperate and kind of frustrated. And I remember I just posted on Facebook one day, I said, guys, I'm looking for a colorist. And does anybody know any good colorists? And I'm Facebook friends with Taylor Esposito, who's a letterer on a ton of books out there.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, have you met my buddy Jason Smith? And Jason, you know, he's a veteran of Hi-Fi, the coloring studio. And, you know, I sent him our pitch pages and it all clicked together. The first six pages of Spencer and Long that you guys have in your trade paperback, that's exactly what we sent Action on. And that's exactly,
very exactly cool.
You know, we made no changes on that whatsoever. And Jason just, you know, and he and I always feel a little bad for him because he and I talk his ear off about color and sort of saying, here's what I'm thinking for this. Here's the way that I think we could make this as dramatic as possible. I have a lot of opinions about colors, but I think that the three of us kind of working hand in hand on that, Jason and Jorge are just like a dream team. It's one of those things that I would not want to have anybody besides Jason working in Jorge's line work. They fit together really well. Nice. And that's, you know, in terms of a lot of the books that I've worked on, a lot of the pitches I've put together, it's finding the right colorist for your line artist. Because if you don't, your book, you're going to notice really fast. Jason, he's terrific. We've actually got some really cool new tricks with the coloring in volume two, that I can't spoil too much yet, but, I will say that our third issue, we kind of pull some cool stuff out, is very exciting. And I think makes the book, you know, sort of keep its sort of visual uniqueness.
That's awesome. Yeah. And very, yeah. The uniqueness is a definitely great word to put on this for sure. Before we get too deep, because I just don't remember having it, I don't have it in my notes, but where would be the best place for people to go and pre-order Spencer Unlocked 2 for you? What's going to be best for you guys?
Best way to do it, call your local comic shop. Cool. And you can pre-order right now. The first two issues are available in previews. We've got three covers each for all four of our issues for this arc. So the codes are, I say this every night before I go to bed, so I remember these. So issue one, it's Feb 1913 09, Feb 1913 10, and Feb 1913 11. And then for our second issue, it's Mar 1913 29, Mar 1913 30, and Mar 1913 31, I believe it is. And we've got covers from Jorge Santiago Jr., of course, and then we will also have variant covers from Mon House and Joe Mulvey. They are also returning from volume one. And calling your local comic shop, that's the best way to do it. I'm not gonna shame people for buying stuff digital or trade waiting. I get it, like it happens. Pre-orders make or break indies like ours. And you know, the thing is that Action Lab, I'll just say it, Action Lab has told us as long as our sales aren't in the toilet, they'll let us do a volume three. So
I like them.
Make sure that we
go Action Labs. Yeah.
As long as our sales are not in the toilet.
My heroes.
And let me tell you, I volume two is our Empire Strikes Back. And I don't invoke
Walton. Oh, man.
You're going to. All I'll say is after reading volume two, you're going to want a volume three.
Nice.
We've got plans for it.
Pre-order now.
Pre-order now. Final order cutoff for issue one is April 1st. You can pre-order the first two issues, you know, kill two birds with one stone. And or just tell your local comic shop, hey, put Spencer and Locke 2 in my pull list. I promise you will not regret it.
Nice. And that's one of the big things here with us at Comics for All. You know, we always talk about the artists, the creators, you know, the people who may necessarily aren't on the cover of the book, which you guys put on the covers of the trade for sure. And you even mentioned Colin's name, Colin Bell. I know you said you've known him for a while. You know, what's kind of your guys' history together?
So Colin, I guess this ties in a little of my secret origin, which is I got my start as an editorial intern at DC Comics a little over 10 years ago. I was there the summer of 2008, all the way really until almost the end of the year. And I worked on books like Final Crisis. I worked on Batman R.I.P.
Just little things, guys. Okay. Yeah.
It was an amazing experience. But it was also during the recession, so there were no jobs whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I happened to meet Janelle Azzelin, who had just been hired as an assistant editor in the Batman office. And she was an alumni of Newsarama.com. So, you know, as a sort of a recent college grad who didn't really know what to do with himself and there were no jobs to be had, I asked Janelle for advice and I said, what can I do? And so she actually connected me with her old editors at Newsarama, and I wound up becoming a reviewer over there, and then actually wound up stepping up, sort of rising up the ranks over there, and became the reviews editor. So I was in charge of Best Shots over there. You know, one of my jobs was recruiting people and, you know, just finding people all over the internet who I, you know, it's sometimes a thankless gig, often a thankless gig, but who would sort of, you know, be willing to be in the trenches sort of, you know, reviewing books week in and week out. And so I found Colin Bell that way. He had been writing online, you know, just writing reviews. And, you know, he was a really terrific reviewer and we got along really well. He eventually moved on to start a career as a letterer. And, you know, we kept in contact. Like I said, you know, sort of when I said, maybe I'll try writing a book of my own, Colin was the first person I spoke with. Because I was like, hey, you're an actual professional in this industry. And so you know a lot more than I do, having been, you know, even on the intern side of things, or even having been, you know, on the journalism side of things. You're in the trenches, like, how do I do this? And so Colin was a really helpful resource. And I really attribute, I mean, again, a lot of this stuff, you wouldn't sort of necessarily recognize the differences until you're sort of confronted with them in your face.
Okay.
Lettering is a huge part of that, especially for a book like Spencer and Locke. You know, we do a lot of the banter, a lot of the one-liners, sort of a very Shane Black, Lethal Weapon kind of thing. And you have to have the lettering has to flow in a way that's very effortless in order to sort of get those one-liners to kind of sneak up on you. And I don't know if you guys know this from having read my book, but I write a lot.
a little bit, yeah. Well, the other thing is it's a very quick read. It's not like we're trudging through the pages by any means, you know?
But I definitely, you know, especially with that genre. Yeah. You know, and I have a lot of opinions on this myself, but, you know, some comics are very against having narration. I think that's a very useful tool, especially when page space is at a premium. And so Colin, you know, kind of makes it all look effortless, which I know full well it is not effortless for him. you know, so he, you know, he's really terrific. And he was kind of a wonderful foundation for me in terms of learning how to work with other letterers. Because, you know, Colin, to me, is kind of the gold standard. You know, I sort of everybody else now I compare to Colin. You know, it was particularly helpful in me teaming up with Ariana Maher on going to the chapel, who, I mean, she's got the patience of a saint for dealing with me. I don't thank her enough, but she deserves all the thanks in the world for putting up with me. And, you know, it's just sort of there's a lot of like subtleties to it, from the lettering to the coloring to, you know, just the way that, you know, panel layouts are thought up, that you wouldn't ordinarily think about it just as a consumer or even necessarily as a reviewer. But when you're sort of confronted with it on, you know, behind the scenes, you're like, oh, there's a lot of differences here. And so then you kind of have to figure out, all right, what's the best avenue to take it?
Absolutely. And it's huge that way in so many respects, because, you know, those names, I can't tell you how many times we are sitting on this show and we're talking about it. We're talking with amazing creators like yourself that, you know, we hear these names of letterers and inkers and, you know, colorists. That it's just like, oh, wait, hold on. Did you see this issue that they did or this series that they ran on? And yeah. It really, like, you're 100% correct. It makes and breaks some of these runs that people will have. And indie like yourself, you know, you want to make sure everything's at that level of the best you can have. So
I agree. I mean, you know, so much of it is, and I talk a lot with retailers. I actually spoke with something like 1,200 retailers talking about Spencer and Locke 2. And
I walked in the afternoon after you had called one of my nearby ones. The girl at the counter said, "And guess who called us this morning?" I said, "Who?"
Yeah, and honestly, my only regret is that I couldn't call more. Wow. You know, just wow. Something that I sort of a sentiment that I picked up from a lot of retailers is there's a lot of product on the stands. And I don't know if you guys were following the news over at Comics Pro, but that's sort of the big retailer convention that took place just a few weeks ago. And, you know, a thing that a lot of retailers were talking about, especially people like Brian Hibbs or Joe Fields or Phil Boyle, they were talking about sort of, you know, the number of variants that are going, you know, that are being sort of spread out amongst titles.
Mind blowing.
And, you know, you mm-hmm. look at a book. You know, not to like pick on any particular book, but you look at a book at like say Conan the Barbarian, where it's got 16 covers. You know, that's suddenly 16 different covers that a retailer has to sort of take into consideration and figuring out well which of these 16 might sell, and is this cover artist even going to be back next month? So I feel like quality control is like a huge is it's really incumbent on the indies, especially because look, I'm not Batman, I'm not Spider-Man, I don't have that instant name brand recognition. This is my first book, I don't have that track record. I'm not a Jason Aaron or a Kieran Gillen or a Brubaker or a Fraction or a Brian K. Vaughan. So the only sort of trump card I have is can I make this book look and read as awesomely as possible. There's a lot of books that, you know, they're racing a deadline and, you know, so it can't always be, you know, they can't always swing a home run, like the law of averages plus double shipping. Like it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You can't all be Tom King. And
we all try to be though, you know, it's on your wish board in the morning when you wake up and, you know, you see yourself in the mirror. You're like, I got you. Today is my day, Tom King.
As an indie creator who is not beholden to the scheduling pressures of the big two, I have the time to sort of make this right and make this as good as I possibly can. And I think that's part of the reason why I love Spencer and Locke the way I do is I think there are a lot of creators out there for their first book, they might sort of feel a little weird or embarrassed by it. I don't. I go to sleep every night with a clean conscience, knowing that we left it all on the field for that book, and we're leaving it all on the field for volume two. And so, you know, I'm going to see 2E2 later this week, and I know that like I can go to that con and sell that book as hard as I can because, you know, I know that my team worked their asses off. And you know they I think they really knocked it out of the park.
Nice. Well, and thank you for, you know, leading a team like that as well, where you realize you have that asset that a lot of those big those publishers don't allow their creators to have a lot of the times, and that's time. Sure. That's time to make it the way you want it to be.
There's time.
And, amen. You know,
I talk about this with a lot of my friends. You know, there's a lot of constraints and pressures that go into it. I mean, you know, I get it. If you're at a Marvel or a DC, you have to have a Batman book, or you have to have an X-Men book, or you have to have, you know, a Spider-Man book. And, you know, based on sort of their market forces and their market pressures, you know, they're doing biweekly books, which seems like a real challenge to me. I empathize with them. But I think that's kind of the fun part about being in the creator-owned sphere is that I think anybody who's making books just to make books, just to fill up space or make product, they're doing this for the wrong reason. And it's not to say that there aren't some creators out there who do that. I mean, you know, there are some where, you know, you'll see they've got a new book out every month. And, you know, I don't know, I talked with a publisher recently about this, and I was in full agreement with him, but he said, especially when you're starting out, consistency is more important than quantity.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing, I think, for a lot of creators, you know, because they see people getting, you know, announcing new books at conventions, and then they get, you know, insecure and they get jealous and they say, why don't I have a new book out? And I, you know, I've struggled with that from time to time. And I just have to remind myself that the only race that I'm running is my race.
Yeah.
And the only name that I have at the end of the day is my name.
Yeah.
Damn.
You know, so if I'm not putting out books that I believe in, if I don't put out books that I feel good about, if I'm not putting out books that I think, you know, sort of check all the boxes in terms of sort of narrative structure and storytelling fundamentals, what the hell am I even doing here?
Right. And comic books is it's a medium where the fans, the people who are grabbing all this material, they're going to expose that person who's not putting in joy and in heart to this medium and to these comics, because they put so much of themselves into this medium, into this source of media, and they're going to get exposed pretty quickly, usually, if they're not a part of some of those big machines that are just pumping out titles all the time. So
yeah,
or even just focus, like you were saying too, it could even be just that simple. Because I mean, it's going to sound hokey, but my goodness, I had to keep buying the next issue and the next issue of Spencer and Locke, and the whole reason. And enjoyed the heck out of volume 2, number 1, for the same reasons. Thank you again, by the way. Because it really is on par with that, you know, with the hot chatter, you know, buzz title, you know, Fearscape from Vault Comics, because those are the two comics that I've encountered, and I have to cut my list down further than I want it to be, but I try to encounter as many as I can. And those are the two that I have encountered that I think, yeah, maybe the creators could fairly sit down and say, I could do that better. I could do that better. Yeah, all right, maybe you've got a good point. But I think those are the two that did everything they needed to do, like set out and nailed everything they wanted to do. And I mean everything from, like you were saying, just focus on covers. Mulvey was most of what pulled me into your book to begin with. Seeing a splash page, as I've already mentioned to these guys, probably more than twice by this point, seeing the splash page ad of Spencer and Locke posed in the alleyway, gun out and snarling, it's like, what's this? And then seeing the little tagline of his partner's imaginary, but the danger's all real. And yet I realize I have to start publishing corrections to my own article all over Twitter, because I got the colors on that ad wrong. The visuals that were put together were so strong that the reds and the blues and the yellows that are so powerful all the way through it had stuck in my head. And I went to the point that I went back. I had the Mandela effect with that freaking splash page. I looked at it like, that's mostly yellow.
Yeah.
Whoops. But it's like that, because I mean the colors are that strong. I'm looking at the four. I'm starting to blather. I apologize. I'll cut it off quickly. But the colors are almost. I need to find out if it was intentional. Really echoing the literal four color comic strips, like evokes that so strongly. The letters, the boxes, flip back and forth from genres. Ah, it's great.
Our second issue. Covers the red and purple one. Yeah, that one that you have up, that red and purple one. So a funny story about that one. I actually did the colors on that one.
Very cool.
It's late enough that I can say the story. So I love Action Lab. They have been so wonderful to us, and they've sort of given us carte blanche to tell the story the way we want to. So I have nothing. They're wonderful. I will never say a bad thing about them. The thing was with the first volume of that book, I, you know, they're busy. They have a lot of bandwidth going on. They didn't know me from Hole in the Wall. And so I didn't know if I had variant covers for this series. And so I commissioned Joe Mulvey and Mon House to do the first variants for issue one. And I was told, I want to say I was told 2 weeks before Christmas. So we had already announced the book. And I was told about 2 weeks before Christmas, hey, do you have any more variants? And I was like, what? So I had to, thank goodness, Monhouse, wonderful guy. He's doing covers for me on going to the chapel as well. Awesome. I was able to sort of snag him and say, Mon, I need you to do 3 more covers for me, and I need the first one in 2 weeks. and so that cover was the first one that he did. And I had mentioned to him, I said, I really love the two-tone colors that you had done for our first issue. And not to blame on one iota, but he was like, crime-like. I mean, he made it like with, I think, like 4 hours to spare.
Dude.
The problem is that he didn't remember about the colors.
Oh, no.
And so there are just standard covers. And so I actually raced onto Photoshop. And thankfully I know how to work Photoshop. And so I put those colors together at like the last second. I think we turned that cover in with like half an hour to spare.
Holy cow.
And okay. That was the first cover of ours to sell out at Diamond. So,
that's awesome. Really applause. Yes. All around.
Yeah. Yeah. If you guys only knew how many times that I've sort of been like, okay, we've got this deadline. How are we going to hit it? And sort of pulling a rabbit out of the hat to make it work. That's like the fun of comics. I used to be a newspaper reporter, so that stuff happened to me every night.
Yeah.
And it's fun, but afterwards you are just going to like melt into a puddle. You're like, the adrenaline's gone. I'm done. I'm going to pass out. Till the next
time. Yeah. Let me breathe until my next deadline.
Yeah, I get it. Like, I totally get that.
Yeah. I will say another story for Mon, and I'm sorry to blow up Mon's spot because he's a sweetheart. I love him to death. Our third issue variant that he did with our space alien on there, sort of the orange and green variant, which is probably my favorite of his covers for volume one. He actually drew that in one day.
Wow.
We had discussed Dude. Sort of thumbnails, and then he turned in a cover, and it wasn't quite the sort of thing we discussed. And I was kind of like, oh man, like I thought we had like a really cool design. Like, you sure there's no way we could like just take another pass to like clean it up? And he's like, oh yeah, no problem. And then the next day he turns that in, and I was like, holy shit. I was like, this is amazing. So yeah, no, he's super talented. That's and you know, amazing. I really need to give a shout out to Joe Mulvey as well. He wasn't able to do a bunch of variants for us in our first arc just because the timing of it all, like I said. But now that we know that we have variants for volume two, he's on board for the whole thing. And he is just killing it. We have not released our issue 3 covers yet, but his variant is probably my favorite for the second arc. We get to homage one of my favorite comic book covers of all time, but we take like a fun twist on it that I don't talk about for spoilers, but he kills it. His head's going to get even bigger than it already is because I'm talking about him this way, but he is such a Mulvey I've actually known for a long time as well. And he was actually the first person I reached out to for variant covers. And he's terrific. And if you guys haven't read his upcoming book, Wailing Blade, I believe that's in previews as well over at Comics Tribe. I don't know the code for it off the top of my head, but he's like if Joe Madureira had like an illegitimate child.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, that's Mulvey in a nutshell.
I dig it.
Correct.
So you talked about, you know, that comic book life, right? Those deadlines, things like that. Yeah. Were there any ideas that kind of hit the cutting room floor that you wish had made it into that first Spencer and Locke or anything that you're hoping to bring back in, anything like that?
So the answer is yes. And thankfully, I was able to fit a lot of those into volume two.
Nice.
I'll say, without too many spoilers, for example, when I tried so hard writing our car chase in the second issue, I desperately wanted to include Calvin's killer bicycle.
Okay.
With motorcycles. And first arc, we got a great riff in the killer bicycle in volume two. Trying to think what else. I wanted you know, I was happy we got a little bit of the snowmen in volume one, but I kind of wanted to do some more of that. So we got the way we figured that out, I'm really happy with in volume two. And then, Calvin had all sorts of like alter egos going on. And, for our first volume, of course, we were going to do Spaceman Spiff. anybody who thinks of Calvin and Hobbes, it's probably one of the first things to go to.
Absolutely.
We got another one of we have a nice nod to one of Calvin's other alter egos in the book. That was sort of a last minute audible that I called while writing it. It was not in the original sort of treatment. And I'm really happy with how it turned out. It's probably sort of my favorite sequence in the whole series and the whole sequel. There were definitely things that like I couldn't fit in. And I've mentioned this elsewhere before, but once I wrote the first issue of Spencer and Locke and I decided I kind of wanted to go through with it, I really liked it, I reread the whole series and I took notes on it just to sort of say, what's the iconography here? What are some of the themes that Bill Watterson was playing with? And, you know, what can I sort of use to address, you know, this sort of dark noir storyline? And then before I started writing volume two, I reread it again. And, I hope to reread it again. If we get a volume three going. And, I think the hardest thing about volume one, to be honest, was just not spoiling what I thought volume two should be. For those who don't know about what's going on with Spencer and Locke too, if our first series was What If Calvin and Hobbes Grew Up in Sin City, our sequel is taking the fables approach across the funny pages.
Ooh.
So hard-boiled Calvin and Hobbes versus hardcore Beetle Bailey is our sequel. And, I've had that idea in my back pocket before I approached Jorge. Our Heath Ledger Joker meets the Deer Hunter meets Travis Bickle.
Yeah.
Rose Bailey is our villain's name. And he's been in the back pocket for a long time.
Nice.
I saw the cameo with Nancy and Sluggo, by the way. I was like, did you? Yeah, you did. Okay.
Apologies to Olivia James in advance for what we do for her poor characters in this book. I will say, without spoiling what's up with Nancy, I'll just say that I included her cameo well before the Nancy and Sluggo sort of.
Your timing just keeps being great. Your timing just keeps being great.
I'm like, wow, I really was ahead of the curve on that one. I mentioned it to Jorge at like the last possible second too. He was like about to start drawing that. And I was like, you know what would be really funny if we had Nancy and Sluggo in here? And I was like, because they just look like weird homunculi. And so he drew it, and then Olivia James just like blew up the internet. Sorry, Olivia, I apologize. I'm a huge fan, and this was before I got to know your work. So apologies.
Fun conversation, and it has been such a delight to hear all of this.
Thank you for the kind words about the book, and I hope you're around for volume two. I think you're really gonna dig.
Cool.
I'm definitely, as soon as you mentioned a volume three, I was like, oh, here we go. It's exactly what I wanted to hear tonight.
I'll say that I've known the beginning and end of volume three for 4 years now.
Oh, the teasing. So
Pete here is my fiance. You know now that everything he's listed tonight is like on my birthday and Christmas and anniversary wish list.
Well, no, thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the kind words and like thank you for having our backs because look,
absolutely.
My first book, like
it's amazing.
It does not read like it.
It really doesn't. It's phenomenal. Like I have gone on like entire academic level dissertations about this thing. I have been like deconstructing it to Peter and to my brothers. Like, no, you don't understand the themes in this book. And you have to see this transcendence of childhood themes. And they're just like, please stop talking. You talk too much.
I love that. I love hearing that.
I love it. I love it.
Since we're going for abrupt but fun interruptions, one of the things I've been dying to ask is going to the chapel the romance you referenced in that Q&A?
Yes, it is.
Awesome.
Thought so.
It's been killing me for the last couple of months not being able to talk about it. That is a book that I have been. That book I started working on after the first Spencer and Locke came out.
Okay.
I was the best man at, my best friend's wedding. I think it was the week after the election. I was like the worst best man on the planet. It wasn't even for like lack of trying. It was just cursed. The whole thing was cursed. The wedding was beautiful and they're still married. Like everything's good there. But, the guy running the bachelor party, it was cursed. Airbnb was trashed. All the stuff I had rented, like the rental got all screwed up. A bunch of grooms failed at the last second. I actually wound up getting hospitalized like 2 days before the party.
What?
I couldn't even go. everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And I thought to myself, I got hospitalized with a kidney stone. 48 hours before the party. So I couldn't even fly. And I remember thinking to myself, well, thank God this didn't happen during the wedding. And then I thought to myself, well, what's the worst thing that could happen during the wedding? And that's what turned into going to the chapel. I thought, well, you know, the worst thing that could happen is if, you know, the bride's father, you know, hired some leg breakers. And then I said, no, there's actually some worse stuff there. What if they just weren't ready? And that became like the real kind of heart of the story. It's very much sort of a story of kind of love and dysfunctional family and sort of what's that leap of faith that it takes to say till death do us part. There's a lot of kind of weird influences that go into it. You know, there's Die Hard. I say it's if Die Hard got hitched to the Runaway Bride.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
I'm in. I'm in. There you go.
About the afternoon. But there's also like stuff, you know, ranging from like Death at a Funeral or Arrested Development.
Yes.
All the way to like Bridget Jones's Diary.
That's awesome.
You know, I feel like. And I'll go back to like talking about the diehard like noir stuff of Spencer and Locke, but I just feel like rom-coms don't get a lot of play in the direct market. And I think there's like a preconception of like what the genre is and who it's meant for. And I kind of wanted to bust that assumption wide open. I want this to be a rom-com that dudes unapologetically love. And I want this to be, you know, an action book that everybody loves. I'm a big believer that, like, comics, the only way that they're going to succeed is if you build a coalition and you bring as many people to the table as possible. And that's through, diversity of creators and diversity of characters and diversity of themes and diversity of genres. And that's something that we tried to really encapsulate with Chapel. And, I can't tell you how many publishers I shopped that book to who said, we love it, we don't know how to sell it. And that's what I give Action Lab all the credit in the world. Same thing happened with Spencer and Locke. I remember pitching that. A top five publisher told me that it was the best pitch he'd never published. And I wear that as a badge of honor. I think that was a very nice thing for them to say. But, Action Lab has not flinched once, no matter what kind of weird crap I throw at them. Because I don't do it just to be weird. I do it because I say I think there's a growth market here. And they immediately are like, that sounds wild. Do it. Let's go for it. And so, you know, they've been such tremendous partners to work with. And I sent them our lettered draft of actually the whole series last week. And, you know, people from Agile Lab have been emailing me being like, wow, the art in this looks terrific. And I was like, it really does. Like, I'm working with a really talented team on it. And so, that was my long way of saying, yes, this was the rom-com that I was talking about in your Q&A.
Beautiful.
Very happy to talk about it, as you can see.
So, nice.
Man, I hope Netflix, to go ahead and go down the fanboy dreams route, I hope Netflix starts a deep and meaningful relationship with Action Lab Comics and starts with Spencer and Locke, then moves on to going to the chapel from the sound of it.
You know, I would not say no to any of that. I certainly wouldn't say no to any sort of Hollywood, stuff going on. And, I will say, you know, we've had some really cool conversations on the Hollywood front, Spencer and Locke.
I Googled your name and IMDb said there was pre-production currently happening for Spencer.
Yeah, so we got options during our first arc. And so there's not a whole lot I could talk about it at the moment other than we've talked with some really cool people about it. I live in Los Angeles, so it's been kind of cool being on the ground floor for stuff like this. Like, I put together our pitch packet for the series, and sort of including kind of our character Bibles and where we saw the series going, and some of the, sort of critical reception that we've gotten from the series. And it's cool being on the ground floor with that.
Yeah.
It's Hollywood. So, things happen all the time. But it's been a really cool experience, even just sort of at this very early stages. Every so often, I sort of let myself daydream a little bit about who I'd fan cast, that's probably the height of self-indulgence, but I just it's been very encouraging to see people, fall in love with this book and fall in love with these characters and seeing that Hollywood gets it too.
Yeah.
That they see that there's a beating heart, to this book. And so,
that's awesome to hear.
I think, with our sequel coming out, I think with, knock on wood, if we get a volume 3, I think good things are in store for us.
That's awesome. And, you talk about that inclusion factor, right? And making sure you're hitting that wide spectrum of people to really, like you said, bring in that comic. And that's who's going to carry it. One of the things that, myself, Ali, Max, Pete, we talked about with Spencer and Locke was there seems to be a lot of themes around mental illness. And that's something we've talked about quite a bit here on Comics for All. We are big proponents of NAMI.org for people to go and seek help and look for those things.
Yeah.
Can you tell us if there was, any really kind of major kind of influences for any mental illness or health around you or anything like that kind of inspired some of those themes?
Well, I mean, it started off, I certainly have kind of a depressive streak. I think a lot of people in my family do, I think sort of treating mental illness with a level of empathy. I think that was kind of the way we wanted to approach it. At first it started just sort of in terms of my interests. My favorite movies are Memento and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Sort of being able to use someone's mental state as sort of as more than just the window dressing.
Absolutely.
Sort of an actual realm to explore. Memento in particular, I really enjoy because it's the story of somebody who has kind of a disability, but who's able to leverage it in a way that maybe it's not a superpower, but it's sort of their way of navigating the world.
Yeah.
It's a coping mechanism. And actually somebody asked me this in an interview and it kind of hit the nail on the head for me that I didn't even know that I was working with, which is all my stories in some capacity are about coping mechanisms. Usually the more unhealthy, the better. I'm sure there are people out there who are super well adjusted and super happy and super resilient and all that. I'm kind of jealous of them.
Yeah.
I feel, I feel like people get knocked down all the time. And, you know, sometimes really the only victory you have is that you can get back up from it. But, you know, I certainly replay my failures and my heartbreaks and my depression, you know, more often than I'd like to.
Yeah.
And I think being able to have a character who does something similar, I think you can't help but have some empathy for that. And then you sort of realize, oh, maybe I'm also kind of beating myself up over stuff that I didn't have control over, or stuff that, you know, I didn't know, or stuff that, you know, just wasn't your fault. And, you know, I think everybody's got things in their past they don't like to think about. And I think that's the human component to Spencer and Locke. And I think this idea of sort of finding a character who's just so, he comes from such a bleak and kind of hopeless place, and yet he's able to sort of invent his own salvation. Like that I think is kind of, it's very inspiring. And we actually, I mentioned this in our afterword for our trade paperback, was, you know, if Locke can sort of take all these hits and get back up, so can you. So that's why, you know, when people say, oh, is this a depressing book? I say, well, I think there's sort of this core of redemption to it that I think it's very inspiring, at least to me.
Absolutely. And I think that's where it kind of resonated with so many of us. And Allie, go ahead.
No, it absolutely is. I mean, as somebody who, I mean, I get 100%. I get into these mindsets sometimes, and it's hard to kind of crawl your way out of the deep, dark, spiraling hole that you've created for yourself. And something that I took away from the book that I loved was this, it was like Spencer had this warm blanket of like, it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this together. I've got your back. And I think everybody needs that, whether you've created it yourself, whether it's like, I have a fluffy from when I was, you know, a baby that I still sleep with. I'm 32 years old.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. But I mean, like, if something, it's one of those things where you just need that. And I think that that was something you did so well that touched me as a reader to be like, I get that. I 100% get that.
You know, I think everybody needs somebody. And, I think oftentimes people get into that spiral because they think it has to be a significant other, or it has to be a parent. And, you know, I mean, you know, I consider myself really fortunate. You know, I mean, I have a partner who's, you know, very supportive of me. And I, you know, my parents, I swear my parents are not based on my parents are Spencer. you know, they've been nothing but supportive. You know, I have my younger siblings who, you know, I think would do anything for me. And, you know, I have a core group of friends who, you know, I bounce stuff off of all the time. And I think, you know, people are built to connect with one another. And I think, you know, you don't need much to do so. And I think no matter how alone you feel, there's always going to be people who want to connect with you. And I think, you know, that's something that I hope our readers understand, is that, you know, we're humans are meant to be together, and we're meant to connect with one another. And I think, you know, it's never too late to reach out.
Yeah,
it's never sort of too late to pull yourself back up.
And thank you for sharing that more than anything. And Allie, you know, you as well. And I think that right there is the absolute antithesis of where I didn't, you know, necessarily see it myself. And I always consider myself very lucky, because I have so many friends, you know, find themselves in those places. You know, Allie is, I've known her for many years and we've talked for a long time. And, you know, those are things I know people struggle with. And it's so hard for me to sit there and try to say, like, I understand those things when I don't suffer from them as well. But when I see them on the pages and I see things coming out that help me understand those ideas and those thought processes and those states of being, it rings true, because it really makes me feel like, hey, my friend isn't alone. The person I care about isn't alone. And that's huge, man. That's so big. And thank you for, you know, having that there and opening up about that for us.
Thank you.
Amen. Amen. That's, I mean, to go ahead and be, oh, no, go ahead, Allie.
Go
You guys are good.
All right. Well, fine. I'll just have to be cheeseball. Be the first cheeseball then, because it'll be the complete stereotypical dork thing to say. I'm on a roll tonight with that, apparently. But
go for it.
I would, the crossover that will never happen that I think would be letter perfect with Spencer and Locke would be Spencer and Locke and the Incredible Hulk, especially with the studies that the Immortal Hulk team has put through together that's so heavily about the relationship, deep diving the relationship between the Hulk and Bruce Banner. Yeah. I would really want to see just interactions, like even if it were just one of those weird diner comics that I've seen people phrase it, say snootily about sometimes. I think that would be amazing because it's just such a, Spencer and Locke, the characters are such a deep dive there.
Yeah.
And partly because he's like, all of us have been saying, partly because that Spencer is so, has such deep disadvantages and they're mostly mental. And to stay away, like you've said, without any major spoilers, might even be walking into volume two with more of them.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's one of those rare stories that he's not battling them. It's literally just treated as this is his life. This is just, and here's the story of how he works with it. It's I must conquer. It's not, I must conquer myself. It's this is just life. My problems are these. And that's really delineated really, really well. Like, you guys knocked that out of the park, making it feel just that's rough, but okay. Just feeling organic for him. Like, it doesn't feel strange as that might seem with a Blue Panther being involved.
I will say, it's funny you mentioned some of this, because I think that's some of the stuff you're talking about we tackle in volume two, which is, Locke, and I can mention this because we've had the previews out, is that we in our second volume, Locke is under investigation. He's been suspended from everything that's happened in volume one, because you don't leave a body count like that without somebody calling you to task for it. And Spencer and Locke are going to find themselves at a real sort of existential crossroads. Because without spoiling too much of volume one, they went back to their old neighborhood and they confronted a lot of the tormentors of their past, and they don't feel any better about it. That's the thing, is that Locke is learning that catharsis doesn't come from the end of a gun, and that he's starting to realize that maybe his coping mechanisms aren't as healthy as he thought they might be. And that's sort of the big head-to-head that he's going to have with Roach Riley, is that Roach is the sole survivor of his platoon from overseas. He saw some stuff over there that, some might argue kind of shattered him, but he would say kind of lifted the scales off his eyes. He's come back with a very nihilistic philosophy on things. And, for somebody who's had as rough of a go of it as Spencer and Locke, that can be kind of an attractive philosophy. And so they're going to have to really do some deep soul searching. And that's the thing I like so much about our sequel, is we're able to take all these sort of things that, a lot of the action tropes and a lot of the things that we set up in volume one that readers can take for granted. And now we get to sort of flip them on their ear a little and interrogate them a little and say, maybe killing people in revenge doesn't help anything. Does might make weight? Can you avenge yourself with violence, or does it just cause more heartbreak? And those are some of the questions we get to explore in volume two. I'm very excited.
I love that, because I'm so tired of the black and whites, good versus evils. And when you insert something like that, that those gray people that live in the grays every single day and that are going to explore those grays areas of what that right and wrong is, especially as adult, detectives here coming on the board. That's exciting. I can't wait for that.
Yeah, it's one of those things, I would never say that Roach is a good guy. I think It's pretty quick. I actually did have one person ask me a while back saying, do you think people are going to look at Roach the same way that they might look at somebody like the Punisher? Which I was like, oh, hadn't thought about that. I hope not. You know, but I do think that Roach, in a way, and I wrote this well before the movie came out, but he reminded me a little bit of Thanos in Infinity War. Sort of, you know, I consider him to be sort of a co-lead to this book, just as much as Spencer and Locke are. And, you know, we get to follow his journey sort of as things go. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say, you know, with our first volume, we started off with sort of these Bill Watterson-style, Calvin and Hobbes-esque homage flashbacks. And all of our flashbacks for Volume 2 are going to be from Roach's perspective. A Mort Walker-style homage.
Dang.
We're going to see kind of the moments that turned him from this sort of lovable, smart-ass, slacker private into kind of this relentless killing machine. And, you know, I think they're very much the unstoppable force meeting the immovable object.
Nice.
And, you know, when those two things collide, you can't help but leave an impression. I wanted to make sure we had a villain that was kind of worthy of Spencer and Locke in the sequel. And I really think we kind of struck Pater with Roach. He just is exactly he's the better class of criminal that this town deserves.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, and you know, we talk about it constantly where every great hero protagonist has to have a great antagonist that sees that mirror to it. And to hear that that's where you're going to go with Roach is, oh man, that is so fantastic. I'm giddy with that, man.
He's my favorite character for the sequel. And that's coming from somebody who loves writing Locke. Locke's actually in third place for this sequel.
Ooh.
Roach just gets all the cool one-liners. He gets all the kind of most exciting bits in the action sequences in my mind. And it took a little while to kind of get into his headspace, but once I did, a lot of the themes and stuff really kind of just started unspooling from there.
I love it. With that being said, I want to talk a little bit about going to the chapel. I know that's an upcoming project for you coming up, and I definitely want to kind of end our wonderful conversation. First off, again, David, thank you so much for coming on. Please, everybody, go to your local comic shops, get that pre-order in for Spencer and Locke 2, get that ready to go so that we can see Spencer and Locke 3. I'm not going to lie. Please get out there, go to those local comic shops like we talk about. TurboComics.com, help those guys out as well. But let's go into going to the chapel, man. So you talked about, you know, the inspiration of what could be the worst thing that could happen at this wedding besides me getting a kidney stone. Cause you know, that'd be my first thing. Like, oh man, David got a kidney stone. The worst thing ever just happened.
Well, so it's, you know, I say it was the wedding from hell, and that was before the bank robbers showed up. Going to the chapel is about a conflicted bride who, on the day of her wedding, her big day, is taken over by a gang of Elvis-themed bank robbers. And unfortunately, the heist goes sideways. And when the cops wind up surrounding the chapel, our bride winds up becoming the ringleader of her own hostage situation.
Wow. Okay. So we have Elvis-themed robbers. Oh my gosh, this is fantastic.
That Elvis gang.
Oh my god, this is the best thing ever.
I love this.
I'm so excited. I'm a huge fan of the movie Point Break.
First thing that popped in my head, I was like, Point Break, Heat. Like, I'm just like, oh, this is gonna be great, man.
And you know, the Elvises, I'm also a huge fan of Dog Day Afternoon.
Okay.
The idea of having, you know, sort of a bank robbery / hostage situation, but at a wedding, kind of made me laugh every time I thought about
Seriously.
It. Seriously. There's so much cool imagery for weddings, and we get to play with a lot of that in this book. But on top of that, I kind of like this idea of seeing bank robbers dealing with just this very rich, very entitled, very dysfunctional family and be kind of locked in close quarters for them for an extended period of time and watch sort of how they start interacting with one another. I'm a huge fan of the film, and it's very underrated. I don't think a lot of people know about it. Death at a Funeral.
Oh, Death at a Funeral. Yeah, fantastic movie.
A lot of people probably know it from the Chris Rock remake, but it's such like this just bleakly funny movie, and I kind of wanted to do something with that in mind, and something that we talked about earlier, you know, in terms of diversity and representation and inclusion. That was actually something that for our first volume of Spencer and Locke, it was the one thing I was left unhappy. And there were reasons why we weren't able to incorporate as much representation as I wanted in that first volume. It was something Jorge and I actually talked about early on. And the problem is that given the subject matter and given sort of how tight and intimate that cast was, it would be bad representation. It would be sort of stuff that leaned into stereotype.
It was the timing.
Yeah. Well, and just sort of, you know, you have a character who's abused and he's, you know, beaten and, you know, his mother, you know, is maybe a lady of the night. Suddenly, you know, it's one thing when you're not including representation in that. Once you do, then that's all people would rightly look at. So that's something we worked on to correct in volume two, you know, sort of increasing our cast size and increasing sort of the representation and diversity with that. But that's something I really wanted to do with Chap. You know, we have, I think it's a cast of 15 people.
Wow.
All locked in sort of a tight, singular location. You know, I wanted to make sure that this was, you know, had a female lead, because I feel like we don't really see enough women action heroes out there.
Amen to that.
For example, you know, the two love interests are both people of color, because, you know, I wrote this well before Crazy Rich Asians came out, but I thought, you know, when's the last time that we saw like a really dreamboat Asian lead as a romantic lead? I feel like it's our responsibility as creators, especially me. I'm a straight white guy, like, and you know, I'm Jewish, but I'm also in a town where like I wouldn't consider myself a minority out here in Hollywood. I think it's incumbent upon creators like me to sort of try to, you know, open that up. I think a lot about Dwayne McDuffie. You know, he was on Justified a few years ago, and the amount of flack he got for having even a handful of minority characters in the Justice League was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I just think that the man was ahead of his time. And I think it's sort of, it is the absolute least we can do as creators. I think sort of trying new things with, in terms of diversity of the cast and the creators and genres and content, I think it not only makes moral sense, I think it makes creative sense. I think it makes business sense. I think it's the only way that comics are going to sort of have a future. And it all goes back to how do we bring as many people to the table as possible?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's going to be jerks out there who, you know, they say it's for some agenda or whatever nonsense. And I would just say that, like, there's plenty of books out there. Like, there's plenty of books out there. What's the harm of trying to bring more people to the table?
Yeah. Just because you like something doesn't mean it's not going to latch onto someone else who's going to love it just as much as you love yours, you know?
You know, so this is a nerdy thing. I used to be the president of my college's comic book club.
Good for you. Yes.
Okay, card-carrying president of the Brandeis comic book club. So that's like three layers of being nerdy right there. And I used to say to myself, I used to say to people as they were walking by at the activities fair, you know, trying to not make eye contact, I would say, you know, everybody's a comics reader. They just don't know it yet. And I believe in that wholeheartedly. I can't tell you how many people have told us that, you know, Spencer and Locke was the first comic that they read, which kind of blows my mind.
Oh, that's so cool.
Dude. Oh, that's so awesome.
And So, you know, with that and you know, I want every comic somebody's first. Stan Lee said that, I believe it.
Yep.
And so for Chapel, you know, I wanted to make a book for people who don't necessarily read these things. Or, you know, for people who do read a certain type of comic, but won't sort of, you know, or will be resistant to reading, to broadening their horizons.
Yeah.
You know, and I can say the early reactions to the book have been overwhelmingly positive. And I think it's because, you know, like people needed, I think they needed that permission. I think they needed somebody to say, it's okay to read a rom-com. Rom-coms are cool.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I mean, maybe it's not a comedy, but like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is one of my favorite movies. I love About Time, as cheesy as
about,
that movie is.
So one sec. Because About Time is phenomenal, and anybody who says differently, I will fight on the streets, Spencer and Locke style.
Taking a genre twist on these sorts of stories, I mean, it's in a lot of ways, I think romantic comedies are just as resilient as crime in that regard. And that's why there's kind of a cool overlap. I mean, you think of people having phrases like crimes of passion or partners in crime or, you know, things like that. And I don't know. It was just one of those things. I was kind of surprised nobody had ever done it before.
Well, I love that you're taking that experiment with it, though, it's not even an experiment, right? Because rom-coms are one of the biggest genres in any media, right? Books, TV, movies. The difference is where, you know, the single white male spends most of his time is not around the rom-com community, right? It doesn't mean it's not good. It doesn't mean it's bad. It means that it's just something you're not exposed to. And with you bringing that into comic books, that is so exciting to me, because I constantly, you know, me and my girlfriend, like I try to show her things that I think she'd really be interested to, and it just doesn't have that hook. You know, it doesn't have, some of those books just don't have that hook. And this would be something where I guarantee if I told her, hey, this is a heist at a wedding, I could probably get her really interested really quickly.
Exactly. And, you know, I feel like when I'm at conventions, I like to ask people just to, you know, if they make the briefest bit of eye contact, I'm shameless about it. I just say, hey, do you like Calvin and Hobbes? If so, let me introduce you to your favorite comic.
Heck yeah.
You know, this is a book that I think is really fun because, you know, you can ask people, hey, are you into Die Hard? Hey, are you into romantic comedies? Hey, do you like Bridget Jones? Hey, do you like Arrested Development? And if anybody says yes to any of those things, here's a book tip for you.
That's so exciting. That's so cool.
I like all of those things.
Yes. Every one of them. D, all of the above.
Allie, we've got a comic book for you. Just listen.
I've got a book for you. And let me tell you, I have to give my whole team a lot of credit for Chapel. Gavin Guidry is the next household name. He really operates in that space between like a Chris Somney and a Doc Shanner. He is just, and he's monstrously fast. I can't tell you how fast he is. Just really, really terrific all around. He actually, this is a little cool behind the scenes, he actually created a three-dimensional Chapel on SketchUp, fully populated. So, you know, so the setting is consistent.
That's cool, man.
Liz Kramer, actually, this is her, both Gavin and Liz's direct market debuts. Liz Kramer, our colorist, I keep saying she's going to be the next Laura Martin. She is just phenomenally good. She's got just a lovely sense of texture that comes with the book. And she and I talked a lot about, we looked at a lot of the color schemes from, that Patricia Martin did over in Secret Weapons, and that Matt Wilson did on Black Widow. You know, sort of looking at those palettes as our inspiration, and then Ariana Maher, who is funny. She's sort of our veteran of the group. You know, she's been on so many amazing projects. I was clued in on her over at Nancy Drew because I thought her work on that was so terrific. And yeah, we're working with a phenomenal number of artists, of cover artists on this series. I can tell you right now, we're working with Lisa Durrell from Long Lost. She's got a wonderful cover that we actually have a con exclusive variant of at C2E2 this weekend. Mm-hmm. And Mon House making the jump from Spencer and Locke on this. And we have a bunch of other really talented artists that I can't share just yet. One of them sent me a sketch for a chapel cover actually today. And I was just like, I was doing like the Antonio Banderas gif where I was just like, yes. It's a fun book. It's got a real personality to it. I hope people kind of latch onto these characters in a way that they might for Spencer and Locke. If you've ever been afraid, in a relationship, or you've ever been unsure, or you've, wondered if you've ever moved too fast, or if you've ever had some unresolved baggage, these are all things that I think a lot of people relate to. And that's, again, sort of going back to the same thing with Spencer and Locke, is what's the human question here?
Yeah.
What's sort of the thing? I call it the grandma test. How can you describe this to your grandma in a way that she'll understand it?
Yeah.
If you can sort of boil it down in that way, kind of get the human element in there, then I think you're working with something that's got some legs. If grandma says, "Oh, that's interesting," then maybe you need to streamline it a little bit.
Or maybe rethink it. Grandma says, "Oh, you're so sweet."
That's so sweet. That's so nice. That's interesting. I joke, my girlfriend's 6 months older than me, so I still call it the grandma test for her. it's really the girlfriend test. Like, is this something that like non-comic civilians can understand? And if it is, then yeah, that's something worth going for. I'm not interested in preaching to the choir. I want converts. That's what I want. I want people who don't know my name. I want people who don't read comics. I want civilians. I'm here to do my part, and I want to bring in some new blood.
I love it.
For what it's worth, I do have to say, Marley, I was genuinely taken aback in every way when Marley said both of her brothers, because they're not, oh, I hate reading type of people, but they're not organic reads, if you will. They're the, I read, I'd say average like once every other month type of people.
Sure.
So they certainly don't touch comics, although they appreciate the principle thing. They don't touch them. So the fact that that not only did she go to them, but they actually sat down and read through Spencer and Locke. I can guarantee you've got at least two added to the list.
that's what I like to hear. It's a very surreal thing for me. We've had a lot of cool successes with Spencer and Locke. We were optioned. We were nominated for 5 Ringo Awards for the first series, which is like wild. We've gotten great press. But I think the thing that's always been like the coolest thing for me is just being at cons and having sort of people who I've never met come up to me and say that they love the book. I got my start writing on the internet, and it's hard not to think, am I just shouting into the void when you do that? And so the fact that these books are connecting with people, it kind of feels like the simulation is glitching a little bit. But it's so encouraging, and I couldn't be any more grateful. And I know Jorge and Jason and Colin and Gavin and Liz and Ariana all feel the same way. There's a lot of books out there, and having sort of the diehard fan base that we've had for Spencer and Locke, and that I hope will translate for Chapel as well. It means a lot. And that's the sort of thing that keeps me going on the days where maybe I don't want to keep going as much. Because if you guys keep reading them, I'll keep writing them.
Heck yeah.
Well, I just think that it's really refreshing to have somebody that's so focused on quality content. I think with the big two, a lot of times you'll find, I gotta get books out. How many more X-Men titles can we do? How many more Batman titles can we do? So it's great for me to pick up a book and go, there is so much love put into this book. There is so much thought and everything that you've done with this book has just been really great and refreshing, because you're not just trying to shove books out. You're really trying to put your heart and soul in it.
Thank you. I mean, you know, some of that comes, it's a combination of like arrogance and desperation.
Sounds like a fine tasting beverage.
I have this conversation with my friends a lot, is the thing that would hurt me the most is if somebody called my book product, because that's not what I want. I'm not looking to make product. And by that, I mean just something that doesn't really have any emotion, doesn't have any sort of value, like emotional value, something that doesn't have a point of view. And I think it's also, though, when I say desperation, I said this before, my name's the only thing I got. And I've tried every stable job out there, and I didn't like them. So this is like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to say my last shot, but like, this is sort of I've tried everything, and this is the job that I like the most. And this is the one that I think I am the best at. And the last thing I would want to do is kind of piss that away with not a bad book. 'Cause look, if I take a big swing and it doesn't work, as long as I took the swing, I'm okay with it. I just don't want to put out a book that I don't feel anything about. You know, you can love it or hate it, but like apathy is like the worst response.
Amen.
I've turned down work that it's because I didn't believe in it. And that's sort of, I guess, a luxury that I have as an indie creator right now, is that, you know, I'm putting in a lot of time and a lot of energy, a lot of sweat, a lot of blood and tears and money and everything else. I'll be damned if I don't love it. And so, I don't begrudge any creators who, you know, their bandwidth is so overclocked that, you know, it's averages. You know, the more work you do, the more likely you'll do something that doesn't work, and that's fine. But I think I never want to be that creator who thinks he can run before he can walk.
Nice.
And putting out books that I believe in, and books that I feel comfortable selling and that I feel comfortable pushing as hard as I can. That's part of the reason why I've really enjoyed working with Action Lab as much as I have, is that they've empowered us as creators to tell the best damn story we can, without trying to put their fingers in the mix, without trying to put their own individual stamp on it. They just let us be us, and I couldn't be more grateful to them for that. I think that's really the secret behind our success.
Well, and what I really want to say, David, is first off, once again, thanks for being on more than anything. We are going to kind of get wrapping up here, because I want to end on that kind of a note, man, where first Absolutely. Off... thank you so much to you and your team for putting that kind of thought and that heart into work like this, because it's something where the people, like you said, those converts, if at all, or the fans of the media in general, they're going to find it, they're going to get their hands on this, and they're going to see that love and that care that you and your team put into this. And thank you for putting that into the world, because not enough people are trying to create and to build. They're trying to tear things down and hurt others and put them down to make themselves feel better. And you're building yourselves up. You're promoting your own work. And thank you so much for that, more than anything.
It's my pleasure. And thank you for having me. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I've been on the critic side of the table. And I think the thing that I would always implore people who want to be critics, and there's nothing wrong with being a critic. I learned everything I could possibly learn from being a critic. Just remember that there's a human being the other side of your critique, and keep it about the work, not about them as a person. I think it's very
yeah.
mistake snark for substance.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people putting kind of their heart and soul into it. And even if it's, even if they do a one-off that's not very good, or it doesn't connect with you, I should say, or even if they do a whole run that doesn't work for you, I think it's incumbent upon us to remember that there's a human being on the other end of the keyboard.
Absolutely.
And to sort of take that in mind when you're analyzing somebody else's work.
No doubt about it. And thank you for that, David. I really do appreciate you, man. Before we go off, though, we have a little segment on Comics for All where we do a what-if scenario, if you will, the kind of the standard, what would you do, who would you bring upon? So I actually had a question earlier, and Pete kind of hit on it a little bit. But what I want to know, and the question to everybody here on the team, is if Spencer and Locke opened up a third member to their group in their car, in their ride, any media, movies, TVs, comics, who would you want the third member to be, or the third name to be plastered across Spencer and Locke with it? Who would be their third partner?
Well, so this will probably be an anticlimactic answer for you. It'd be Hero. It'd be Locke's daughter.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, she plays a big part in Volume 2.
Oh, man.
I said Locke, my second favorite character in the book, or my third favorite character in the book, because Hero is my second.
Oh, wow.
She's kind of the secret heart of the series, and she's got quite a journey ahead of her. That's part of the reason why I want to tell Volume 3 as much as I do, is because she's crucial. She's crucial.
So. All right. There's nothing anticlimactic about that at all. That was awesome. Yes, okay. Absolutely. Okay. That's good to hear.
Terrific. She's Jorge's favorite character to draw, and she's one of my favorites to write. And so
cool.
You know, she will just say for Volume 2, she has graduated from just being the hostage du jour. She's got sort of her own arc, her own journey, her own agency. And, yes,
that's exciting. That's so cool to hear.
So yeah, that's she'd be the one riding shotgun.
Nice. Spencer Locke and Hero, I love it. Ah, that's great. Ollie, what about you? Who would you like to bring aboard?
Can we amend that question and just make Hero as part of the team?
Deal. Like, okay, yeah, so we're looking for a fourth now. Yeah, Spencer Locke, Hero, and we're looking for a fourth.
Okay. So I'm gonna go off Allie's spectrum for once and move away from DC.
Oh, I know. Lucky us. Man, we are all in for a wonderful world right now. We got Hero, we got off of DC from Allie.
All right. Moon Girl and Devil Sword.
Okay, look at you. I like it.
Because I think her and Hero would be badass. I think it would be really cool.
I'm into it.
I can see Locke riding Devil Dinosaur to battle. That would be amazing.
Him, and then you have like Spencer all like brave-hearted up with a broadsword.
Hold on, I'm ready.
Oh, yeah. Variant cover time.
Ooh.
Pete, what about you, sir? Who's going to be your fourth in the gang?
Well, I have to go full circle, because originally I was going to say, no, can't stick with my original, because technically that's cheating, because that would be fourth and fifth, technically.
Okay.
But then I realized the comic strip character who I would love to see spend even a single issue's worth of time with them. But then I also realized I have no idea what's upcoming. So I also can't use that idea. So I'm going to go right back to the crossover that will never happen, but will in my heart. Bruce Banner, the Hulk, Spencer, and Locke. Because, man, the tete-a-tete that any portion of that quartet would have with any other portion would be a sight to behold. They might, even if they didn't end up punching or shooting anybody or nothing explodes, I would be reading that cover to cover so many times.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I'm in. No, I think that's going to be great.
So mine, so I'm shamelessly plugging one of my favorite series. I'm not going to go off the spectrum like Allie did. The Stuff of Legend is one of my favorite runs and books out, and I'm going to add a second favorite animal in, and I'm going to put Max the Bear into the group. So we got Spencer the Panther, Max the Bear. I think that would be just fantastic for me to have another character in there like that. So
yeah.
So Max in there saving his boy out of the closet. I think it'd be a great move to have him in. So, all right. Well, with that being said, thank you guys so much for coming on. Before we get out of here, I want to let everybody know where we can find these amazing books. First off, like Dave was saying earlier, your local comic book store, get at them, get at it, find all those amazing things. Go and find Spencer and Locke issue 1 and pre-order Spencer and Locke issue 2, or the series 2, book 2, if you will. David, where can everybody find you again, my man?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. It's just PeposD. It's my last name, first initial. You can follow Jorge Santiago Jr. on Facebook, or on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at Jorge Santiago Jr. That's just one word spelled out. And you can follow Gavin Guidry on Twitter and Instagram at just Gavin Guidry. I believe that is just one word all spelled out. Okay. And then you can follow the books, Spencer and Locke. That's on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Go to the Chapel. That is also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And Grand Theft Astro, which is also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Nice. Pete, where can everybody find you, sir?
Well, other than Comics for All podcast and at All for Comics on Twitter. Also like to make the appearances I can on the podcast for Malice Corp, All Things Nerd. And I would also love to throw in that if anybody wants notes on where to find the Spencer and Locke team on Twitter, I made sure that's at the end of the article, which I will be tweeting at the public at large and our dear listeners incessantly, I promise. And reminder, not only is the final order cut off April 1st, but any time, especially including but not limited to Spencer and Locke, you pre-order something, that is what drives stores to buying more copies for their shelf more than Absolutely. Anything. So don't feel like you have to, but especially when it's a book, any book you really want to support, that's the biggest thing. You know, that is one of the biggest things. Excuse me, one of the biggest things. I will bow to the gentleman who does this professionally here, but one of the biggest things, definitely.
Nice. Allie, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at lulzpanda, LULZPANDA, and on Instagram at lulzpanda as well. And like everybody's saying, we always want to sub to books. Make sure you're pre-ordering. Make sure you've got them on your pull list. Please, I really want this third volume. So make sure you're doing that. Call your shop. I've got all the codes that he was talking about earlier, so I'll pass those on to Pete. We will post them on Twitter.
Yep.
So that you're not ruining my life and not getting a volume 3 to happen, because I will hold it against all of you.
Yep.
Just FYI.
Absolutely. We also have All for Comics Instagram, which these will be going up on as well. I have them too. You can follow me, Matt, at the Big Papa Matt on Instagram and Twitter as well. But more than anything, wherever you get this show, Comics for All, go and share it with your friends, your family, your enemies, anybody who doesn't care to hear about it. Make sure they do. Follow us on Instagram at All for Comics, or Twitter at All for Comics as well. And thank you guys so much for tuning in. We really do appreciate the time. And David Pepos, thank you once again for joining the show, man. We really can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
No, thank you guys for having me. This was terrific.
Awesome, man.